Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. If I mention the following riders to you, do you recognize them? JMG Leclasio, Erta Muller, Mahmoud Darvish, Edgar Carrot, Per Peterson, W.G. Sebald. What about the emerging riders of the Arab Spring? You might say I'm not able to read them because they're not in translation. I only speak English. Well, Words Without Borders is here to help, and their mission is to connect international writers to the general public, to students, and to educators. They publish an online magazine, same title, Words Without Borders, and that's wordswithoutborders.org. The editor of the magazine is with me in studio. She's on the USU campus today as part of the English Department Speaker Series, and that event is co-sponsored by the Departments of History, Languages, Philosophy, and Speech Communication and the Utah Humanities Council. We're going to talk about Words Without Borders. There's some riveting current literature from the Arab Spring, from Afghanistan. One of the recent issues of the magazine was on international graphic novels. Talk about the state of international literature with Susan Harris. Later in the hour, I'll be talking with Craig Jessup, Dean of the College of the Arts, Kane College of the Arts at USU, talking about a Utah Symphony concert featuring Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. Susan Harris, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate you coming in.
Delighted to be here.
Before we have your description of the magazine, let's hear a bit of audio from your website. This is wordswithoutborders.org, and if you click on the About Us tab, there's an interesting montage. This was filmed in New York, was
it? Yes, in Washington Square Park.
So a lot of different people.
Absolutely.
And the part that we're not going to hear, we'll cut it down for time, is various people just talking about, they're asked, what are you reading?
Yes.
At this point. One gentleman is embarrassed. He says, I'm reading Sarah Palin's book. At least he's honest about it. Other people are, you're reading this and that. Then we get to asking them about what are you reading in international literature? And that's the point where we, this is from Washington Park in New York City.
In terms of foreign books, I pretty much mostly would read British authors.
The concept of like reading other pieces of work in other languages and translated for me if I can't speak that language, I think is something that is definitely suited for my interest.
I'd definitely be interested in that just because ways into other people's worlds, you know, and who's not curious about somebody else's life.
Words Without Borders sounds like a resource I would definitely use. I think a lot of other people would find translations more engaging than they might think that they are.
Best justifications for literature and translation that I ever heard came from a wonderful professor and translator of Greek literature named C.D.C. Reeves, who said to me that people's experience of literature and of art in general is so individual that one can never predict what any given person will fall in love with and what he or she might fall in love with in a way that transforms their entire lives. I'm Elaine Salierno Mason. I'm the founder of Words Without Borders, and we're here at Caputo's Deli in Brooklyn, New York, right around the corner from where Words Without Borders was first founded. I'm Italian American, and I came to my love of international literature really through the love of foreignness given to me by the richness of an immigrant heritage. We are nourished by foreignness. American culture has always been nourished by the foreign. Only about 3% of the books published in the United States have been translated from foreign languages, whereas in Europe, the percentage is more like 50%. Since 2003, Words Without Borders has published over 1,100 pieces from 110 countries and over 90 languages. We have also published 4 print anthologies in collaboration with different publishers. And we are also launching an education project to involve teachers at both the high school and the college level, trying to enable them to incorporate more international literature in the curriculum. We need to have literature and translation because we need the widest possible diversity of work available for people to fall in love with. My hope for Words Without Borders is that it can be a vanguard in the war against ignorance and enable all of us to connect with worlds that are different from our own. We consume delicious foods from around the world. Why shouldn't we consume delicious literature from around the world?
That's a segment from the website, Words Without Borders. We have the editor of the online magazine, Susan Harris, with us. So expanding on that, why Words Without Borders?
As Elaine said just now in the tape, we in the United States know so much of the world through a strictly political prism. And the best way, we think, to understand other cultures is through their literature, to get a sense not only of, to get a sense of individuals, to get a sense of what cultures are like, what people are like, the everyday lives of people who we might otherwise think of monolithically. And it is crucial, as Elaine said, that we understand the rest of the world. And the best way to do that is through literature.
Hmm. Now, a very effective window into culture is language.
Yes.
But we probably can't learn all the languages in the world. So literature is another means.
Absolutely. And of course, as Elaine quoted the famous statistic about 3% of literature in translation, and it's difficult to realize that there is so much of the world to which we simply do not have access. Very few people in the U.S. in particular read more than a couple of languages. That information can only be available through translation, and so much of our mission is devoted to finding these pieces, bringing them into English, and making them available when they would not otherwise be so.
Hmm. We'll ask Susan Harris to read some pieces. I'm very curious about what's out there. Of course, you can go to Words Without Borders and find out. We'll be hearing some pieces, including piece of literature from the Arab Spring. Very interesting. I also notice, Susan Harris, some compilations. These have been printed. Literature from the Axis of Evil.
Yes.
That's writings from Iran, Iraq, North Korea, and other enemy nations.
That very much represents our mission. Again, when Elaine was working to found the magazine, this was after September 11th, and there was a realization that, again, as I said, we know so much of the world through a strictly political prism, and they also have no sense of us. And our first three issues were writing from Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. And correspondingly, we developed this anthology with the idea of making these enemy nations, again, so-called by George Bush, by making these enemy nations by showing the individuals, by showing the culture, by demonstrating that there is more to these countries, to these cultures. Again, the beautiful beautiful Persian poetry of Iran, the wonderful writing in Arabic from Iraq, the very funny writing from Cuba. You know, we have no sense of that if it is not made available in English. Mm. And that our Axis of Evil anthology has, in fact, been very popular for course adoption. Hmm. And I think we published that several years ago, and it is still very much selling. And obviously, the Axis of Evil is still very much, knowing these countries is still very much, very, very important.
Hmm. So you were saying, you telling me before we went on the air, that in and of itself, this translation is a political act.
Yes, because, you know, we are a literary magazine. We are not explicitly political. But simply by making this work available in English, we are making a statement, and we are talking about the importance of global knowledge and understanding.
Hmm. How exotic do you get? There's probably nations we've barely heard of that you have writers that you've translated.
Well, we had a Maltese feature. Again, you had mentioned the issue from Afghanistan. We have published work from every continent, except for Antarctica, of course. Mm. We have published work from languages as major, as prominent as Spanish, which I think the most pieces on this, most pieces on the site. But we also have, again, as I said, Maltese literature. We have Vietnamese. We have Tigrinya, which is an African language. We are still missing some languages and some countries, but we have covered most of the world.
How do you find translators?
You know, we have an extensive network. I have been working in literature and translation publishing since 1985, and so I had a network. Elaine, the founding editor, has a network. Our other two founding editors were also in publishing. We have networks, and We work extensively with publishers and with translators. We're also tapped in with the academic community, where younger translators are being trained, and so people tend to direct public to refer translators to us, and we also have partnerships with institutions and organizations like the British Center for Literary Translation, which has translation workshops every summer, and we have used the graduates of their program. So there are always new translators being developed, and of course, we solicit work as well, from not only from authors, but from translators who are established.
Do you worry about what's lost in translation?
Absolutely, but I think that what is more important is what's found. There are, of course, many considerations in producing an accurate translation. There has to be a sensitivity to cultural nuance and beyond simply the understanding of idiom. But certainly that is what is so important, I think, about our project, because we're not only presenting the literature, but we're also trying to provide a context in which to understand it.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Susan Harris, who is editor of the online magazine Words Without Borders. You can find it at wordswithoutborders.org. And prominent authors, Nobel Prize winners, and obscure authors. And that's the whole point, is trying to bring these authors to light that people in the U.S. would never read.
Absolutely.
But for translation. We're going to hear a piece coming up next. Let me just remind you that Susan Harris will be giving a lecture. It's at 12:30 today in the Alumni House. Everybody is welcome. 12:30 today, Alumni House on the USU campus. It's part of the English Department Speaker Series. And the event is co-sponsored by the Departments of History, Languages, Philosophy, and Speech Communications and the Utah Humanities Council. And recent issues of the magazine have included translation of writings from the Arab Spring, from Afghanistan, international graphic novels. I notice online here the March 2012 issue, The Mexican Drug War. Very interesting. So it takes you around the world, a glimpse into the world through the world's literature in translation. And later in the hour, I'll be talking with Craig Jessup, Dean of the Kane College of the Arts. We'll talk about a Utah Symphony concert be happening on Thursday evening on the Utah State University campus. More information at arts.usu.edu. An option for you to get a pair of tickets, free tickets. We're throwing that out today. So all you have to do is call 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. For two free tickets, the headliner is Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. There's also some Mozart, Mozart Piano Concerto, and a Mozart Overture. It's Terry Fisher, music director, and the Utah Symphony, Thursday evening on the USU campus. A pair of free tickets for you when you call 1-800-826-1495. Also, $2 off your ticket at the box office if you mention that you heard this broadcast. So we're partnering with Craig Jessup over there in the Kane College of the Arts. By the way, we talk about Beethoven and about Terry Fisher. Craig Jessup was on the selection committee. Let's hear, I believe you got something ready from literature from the Arab Spring. This is very interesting. Tell us how Words Without Borders got involved with this.
Well, we plan our issues quite a while in advance. And last year, I had planned for August an issue of Writing from Algeria. And then the uprising started in January. And we quickly realized that we could not do a simple issue of literature without acknowledging the political scene. And then, of course, the dominoes started to fall. And we decided to remake the summer issue, and we pulled together a double issue, July and August, of writing from the Arab Spring countries. Again, the beauty of being online was that it was a scramble, and we worked very, very quickly. But we were able to have a combination of literature and essays, providing cultural insight to the situation, and we also complemented that with blogs, from people on the ground and in other places, talking about what was going on there in the different countries.
Interesting. So you've got a piece you can read for us.
This is an essay that was written by Boualem Sansal. He's an Algerian writer. This is an essay written, an open letter written to Mohamed Bouazizi, who was the Tunisian who set himself on fire and really started the uprising. Another example of the beauty of online publishing, this essay appeared in Le Monde, the Paris newspaper, on June 15th and appeared in English translation in our pages on July 1st. So that's how quickly we were working. But this is a section from this beautiful letter. Dear brother, I write these few lines to let you know we're doing well on the whole, though it varies from day to day. Sometimes the wind changes, it rains lead, life bleeds from every pore. To tell the truth, I'm not quite sure where we stand. When you're up to your neck in war, you can't tell till the end whether to celebrate or mourn. And there it is, the crucial question, whether to follow or precede the others. The consequences aren't the same. Some victories can fall short, while some defeats are the beginnings of truly great victories. In this game where death always takes you by surprise, there is the time before and the time after, but only one extraordinarily fleeting moment to make up your mind. I won't say what to say about Assad. He drives death to despair, killing faster than it does. How long it is, this Arab spring, and how uncertain its days. You, Mohammed, brave and noble son of Sibi Bouazizi, you delivered the spark. Your task is done. The task is ours now to finish. We'll finish it. Our children will live in the peace we have made for them. From where you are, Mohammed, you can tell that not all roads lead to Rome. Ousting a tyrant doesn't lead to freedom. Dear Mohammed, if you can come back, tell them you didn't set yourself on fire for this. Tell them you wanted the dictatorship and its shadows, all its shadows, the straitjackets of clannishness and nepotism. The racism of the state, the only way of looking at the world, Islamism or exile is the only hopes, that you wanted all these fatal things swept from our path to make way for a life that is clean, peaceful, warm, and friendly. That's what I wanted to say to you, dear Mohammed. If you could show yourself and enlighten us, it would be nice. From up there, you know the future of the world.
Tell us again who the writer of the piece was.
Boualem Sansal, an Algerian writer who actually has stayed in Algeria. He writes in French, and he received the German Trade Peace Prize in 2011 for his writing on the topic.
And this is a letter to the man in Tunisia.
Yes.
Who set himself on fire.
Yes.
Sort of the spark for the whole Arab Spring.
Exactly.
From the writers that you've featured on Words Without Borders, is there a theme that, can you take you put your finger on the pulse of where the Arab Spring is now?
Of course, it was not Arab Spring. It's turned out to Arab Years. Mm-hmm. And again, we published a combination of somewhat older work to provide a context and newer work. Obviously, the situation continues. And there is no particular resolution in much of that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. I noticed the letter, he mentions Assad, and that's, of course, where the epicenter of the struggle is now.
Yes.
Are you getting literature, any writings out of Syria these days?
No, it's very frustrating. We have no one on the ground there. It is something that I have been trying to work on, but also the situation in Syria is very difficult for writers. In fact, we wanted a number of writers who we wanted to include in the Axis of Evil anthology could not have their work in that book, for some because of the title, for others because they could not be associated with other Syrian writers who were in the book. It's a very complex situation. Mm. We do need to do another Syria issue. We did one in the early years of the magazine, but we have been thwarted so far.
Undoubtedly, there will be writing coming out of Syria.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we will be on top of it when it is.
I guess that is just part of a natural human impulse to put your experiences down to be heard.
Absolutely. One element of the Arab Spring that we were very pleased with, and this ties in with the graphic novels that you had mentioned, we do a graphic novel issue every February. And in 2008, we did an extract from an Egyptian graphic novel by a novelist called Magdi El-Shafi. It was called Metro, and it touched on corruption in the Cairo government. And we published our extract in February of 2008. His book was published in April. The day it was published, the police stormed the publisher's offices, seized the copies, threw Magdi and his publisher in jail, went to the bookstores and told them, not only must you pulp these, turn these over to us, you must wipe clean any records of this book in your computers. This book never existed. And we covered that. The trial went on. It was extended. It was postponed. Finally, they were fined. But we were very pleased to have published that. And for a long time, that was the only place you could read his work. Well, Magdi was very active in the protests in Cairo, and I asked him to draw me what was happening in Tahrir Square, and so he sent us three panels from the protests and the demonstrations, and showing the broadsides that were being distributed. And one thing, of course, it's very difficult about demonstrations. It's difficult to capture the slogans because they're so dependent on rhythm and rhyme. It's a true translation problem. Mm-hmm. But the translator came up with a beautiful equivalent for one. 2 million people in the square still can't get him off the chair, referring to Mubarak. But wonderfully, by the time we published the piece, they had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be a problem, wouldn't it? Especially songs, slogans,
exactly.
Anything that's so embedded in the language.
Exactly. And so much of translation is finding equivalents for that sort of thing, not only for rhyme and rhythm, but also for context, for nuance, to demonstrate what something means. Mm-hmm.
Egypt is an interesting case. Mubarak is gone, but the army is still in control.
Absolutely.
What are writers saying these days?
I think there's a great deal of frustration. And I think there was so much hope a year ago. I think people are very closely monitoring the situation. And again, it is still a very unsettled situation.
Hmm. If you just joined us, we're talking with Susan Harris, who is editor of the online magazine Words Without Borders. She'll be speaking at 12:30 this afternoon in the Alumni House on the Utah State University campus as a part of the English Department Speakers Series. Words Without Borders is a free online magazine that publishes international fiction, poetry, and essays in English translation. Broad range of countries. You mentioned Malta and some African languages, up to French and Spanish. Most nations around the world are in translation, including writings from the Arab Spring. We've been talking about that. From Afghanistan, international graphic novels, the drug wars in Mexico. The writers range from Nobel Prize winners to obscure authors. We'll also talk about the new education program from Words Without Borders. That lecture at 12:30 at the Alumni House is open to the public. The event is co-sponsored by the Departments of History, Languages, Philosophy, and Speech Communications and the Utah Humanities Council. We have another 20 minutes or so with Susan Harris. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Or you can get an email to us from upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. So I believe the tickets to the concert are gone, Jordan, and we've got their name. We've got their name so they can pick up their tickets. Great. But the concert I'm talking about is the Utah Symphony Concert Thursday night on the Utah State University campus. Information at arts.usu.edu. You still have opportunity to get $2 off your tickets. I believe that's $2 off each ticket when you call. I just mentioned that you heard about Utah Symphony on Access Utah and on Utah Public Radio. They'll give you $2 off. I'll be talking later in the program with Craig Jessup, Dean of the Kane College of the Arts, about that concert. Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, the headliner, and we'll talk about Terry Fisher, the new music director. Craig Jessup was on that search committee. The number again is 1-800-826-1495. We're going to take a brief break soon. I wanted to hear another piece of literature from Words Without Borders.
Okay. This is a poem from our Afghanistan issue. This is written by Zara Hossainzadeh. She is a refugee and now lives in Iran. And this is an example of literature from a country that I think gives an insight to the individuals. It is not explicitly political at all. It's quite a lovely poem. It's called Take a Number on Saturdays. Take a ticket, the prescription, and a handful of torn money. Stand at the end of the queue on Saturdays. Take a number. Tayeba's unwell again. You've got to make a phone call and negotiate a day off from the office. No matter what she sees in her random way, be patient. Pull the moon or a star out of her sleeve. Shopping isn't bad. All the colors make her happy. Buy her some clothes, bangles, shoes, earrings. Don't let your focus stray from the hunt for a bird or a stone. And tell Tayeba to stay away from people. If the shrink has no time to see you again, take those two suspicious little pills again. No, take her to the cinema, head for the hills, just don't give in to the pressures of the world. And then, if all else fails, ask the holy book. Will my sister get better? Do a divination. Take a ticket, the prescription, and a handful of torn money. Stand at the front of the queue on Saturdays. Take a number. So we get a real sense of the quotidian, you know, the everyday in Afghanistan, which we think of as, you know, people living in caves, and it's not at all the case.
Mm-hmm. I suppose one of your big goals is to increase that understanding.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think everything we publish, I think, is directed toward our mission of improving global understanding and allowing people insight into the rest of the world. I loved what that woman said on on the tape you played earlier when, you know, yes, of course, who wouldn't want to know about the rest of the world? Many people don't, and we're trying to change that.
I wondered, did you get any pushback, or do you, when you say literature from the axis of evil? That you, I could see some people pushing back, hey, those are enemy countries.
Absolutely. And, of course, the title is in quotation marks in the cover. We were using it satirically. That book has actually been rejected for course adoption in some universities and some high schools, just, in fact, because of the title. Mm. And other people have felt that we were somewhat flippant about the situation. But I think we are being satiric, and we are pointing out, in some ways, the absurdity of categorizing all countries in one way.
Now, I assume this literature is not, they're generally not spouting the government line.
The only exception to that is North Korea. When we first did our North Korean issue, which was one of the first three issues, we thought that North Korean literature would be like samizdat, like the East European situation where you had subversive writing being smuggled out. And we thought there must be some writers writing against the government. We did not find anything. There is one literary magazine in North Korea. The only official writers are allowed to publish there. Everything is written in the service of the great leader and in the service of government policy. And there is no information available on the authors.
Interesting. So what's that literature like then?
It's very didactic. But there is one of the pieces in the anthology is about a man who is a musical prodigy, but throws that over to go to work laying stones to serve the great leader. And it's very clear that it's, you know, shot through with ideology. We also have a couple of graphic novels from North Korea that we've run in the graphic novel issue. And those pieces are highly political, against very much articulating policy. But also, in one of them, the hero pauses throughout and strikes a pose like the great leader, and the others stand around him in homage.
I suppose that would be on one end of the spectrum.
Exactly.
Where North Korea is such a repressive regime.
Exactly. We are hoping next year is our 10th anniversary, and we'll be revisiting those three topics. And we are hoping this time to see if we can't find more from North Korea in light of the recent death of the leader. And, you know, we are very much hoping that we might be able to find something else. Mm.
Do you think this is, of course, we can't really know, but you've read some of the literature. Do you think this is just very thorough and efficient government repression, or is this a population that's bought into the company line?
I think both. I think that to be a successful writer in North Korea, you have to toe the government line. And if there is other work being done, it is certainly not being published in North Korea. And again, it is difficult. It is difficult to get a sense of what is really going on. Do you have a brand? You know, do you have a faithful population, or is it only the faithful population that is published?
Mm-hmm. Do we have any emigres, exiles, people who are in asylum who are writing?
We do, and we have a number of South Koreans who are more familiar with the situation. In fact, that the advisor for the North Korea section of the Axis Anthology is a South Korean. And even being in Korea, she had a great deal of trouble finding work. Mm-hmm. So it is something we need to revisit and explore.
Interesting situation. But then there are other countries which we see as oppressive, which I assume do have at least underground literature.
Absolutely. You know, we've published from all over the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. Certainly, we've published a lot of work from a fair amount of work from Romania, and we have one early piece we had was a piece written completely in code between two writers, and it was very obvious what they were saying to each other, but unless you were familiar with the situation, you could not see that. In our last issue, we published a piece about the fertility policy under Ceausescu. So you can see that we have, and that's very explicit. So you can see that we've covered the spectrum, for example, from there.
Hmm. I imagine that would have been, or still is, a feature of underground writing, that writing in code.
And we are publishing in November an issue of banned Chinese writers, and that will be very interesting.
Yeah, interesting. We'll talk more. You mentioned very funny writing from Cuba.
Yes.
We'll have to talk a bit about that. We're going to take just a brief break, just a minute break here, and we'll be back with Susan Harris. Later in the program, a conversation from yesterday with Craig Jessup, Dean of the Kane College of the Arts. We'll talk about Beethoven. There's Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, the featured work in a Utah Symphony concert, and that is Thursday evening on the OSU campus. By the way, when you call the box office to get your tickets, you get $2 off your tickets by just mentioning that you heard this broadcast on Utah Public Radio. And we'll talk about Terry Fisher, the new music director. Craig Jessup was on the search committee. Susan Harris is editor of the online magazine Words Without Borders. She'll be speaking at 12:30 this afternoon in the Alumni House on the Utah State University campus, part of the English Department Speakers Series. And that event is co-sponsored by the Departments of History, Languages, Philosophy, and Speech Communication and the Utah Humanities Council. The website, by the way, is wordswithoutborders.org. More following a brief break.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. Tom Williams with you. I'm with Susan Harris, editor of the online magazine Words Without Borders. That's a free online magazine that publishes international fiction, poetry, and essays in English translation. The goal is to make the world a little smaller, promote understanding by translating international writers so that readers of English can put their finger on the pulse of world literature. Words Without Borders has published some books in print, including Literature from the Axis of Evil, Writing from Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. We've talked about those. Other enemy nations, The Wall in My Head, Words and Images from the Fall of the Iron Curtain, and Words Without Borders, The World Through the Eyes of Writers. One of their issues, a recent issue, is the Mexican Drug War. The current issue, if you look right now, is Sex. Now that's the current issue. So a broad range of topics here. We've talked about writers of the Arab Spring, very interesting, writers from North Korea. And I'd like to have you talk a little bit to Susan Harris about that writing from Cuba. You say there's some very funny literature coming out of Cuba.
Absolutely. We have a piece in the Axis anthology, Women of the Federation, and it's very mordant and very, very funny, with, of course, a deep vein of sadness, just about the deprivations of living in Cuba in the isolation, in the very restricted, in the poverty, but very, very funny nonetheless. And again, I think that is another part that we want to, part of our mission. I think there's a tendency to consider any writing in translation and especially from the non-Western world as being very serious and, the long weeping night of Eastern Europe. And, it is important to demonstrate that even in countries where situations are horrible, or certainly from our eyes, there is humor, there is hope, there are individual voices.
I want to ask you superlatives. Is there any one writer piece that just knocked you for a loop?
Oh, there are so many. I can tell you that in our drug war issue, which is the March issue, Carmen Buyosa, the guest editor, wrote an introduction that I think is absolutely brilliant in how it isolates and identifies the particular problems caused by the drug war and the horrible despair that has gripped Mexico as a result. We also have a poem by a Mexican poet, Ambar Past, called Practice for Hangmen, which is a riff on what would be an instruction manual for executioners, which, again, is very, very funny, but also mordant and very, very, very angry, of course, as well.
Mm. Is there another piece perhaps you could read for us?
Yes. I will read from a piece. This is by an Iraqi poet named Salah al-Hamdani, born in Baghdad and living in exile. And that is another, a side note, that is another situation. So many of our writers live in exile. Almost everyone we published in the Arab Spring lived in exile, and that says a lot about the conditions for writers in these countries. But this is a very, I'll only read part of this poem because it is very beautiful. You needn't crucify yourself either on the edge of a page of history that is not your own, or to atone for the dead born of your suffering, for nowhere is there a cry to soothe your pain. You needn't crucify yourself on the banks of the bloody torrents that gush from your body, as the Euphrates bears the secrets of its soul at the dawn of a new defeat. No wound can justify war. You needn't crucify yourself at the end of the day, when you have not concluded your prayers over the fallen palms, for there can be no honorable killer. Baghdad, my beloved, neither father nor son nor God nor prophet crowned by the church will save your soul, neither the one from Mecca nor the prophet of those who refuse to share olive branches in Palestine. Here's my war notebook, years of exile folded into a suitcase, abandoned far too long to the dreams of the condemned. Baghdad, my beloved, squatting in a corner of the page, sheltered from barren days, far from bloody rivers that swept away the names of the dead and people's silence. Baghdad, my beloved, you did not stand shivering in the doorway of the ruined days. A whole civilization geared to killing has robbed you of your innocence.
Tell us again the name of the poet.
This is Salah al-Hamdani.
Mm-hmm. Now, if people perhaps go to Words Without Borders, they read a poet or a writer that they perhaps especially have an affinity with. Can they go and find other works?
Well, much of our mission is devoted to bringing writers who have not previously appeared in English, and so we do get a lot of messages from readers saying, I loved what you read, where can I get the book? Mm-hmm. Or I loved what you published, where can I get the book? But also part of our mission is matching these writers with English language publishers. And we have had a number of our authors sign book contracts after their work appeared in our pages, not only for English publication, but for others, because English is the major language for international publishing as well. And, for example, one of our Romanian authors sold Spanish rights because the Spanish editor couldn't read Romanian but could read English.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Yes. You make connections that way.
Absolutely.
Very international.
Yes.
Yeah. I noticed here on your website you've received a grant from Amazon.com.
Yes.
You might think, well, there'd be some competition there. Of course, you know, you wouldn't be a huge competition to Amazon,
right.
But there's maybe a partnership.
Amazon has started funding nonprofit publishers, and there's actually been a bit of a kerfuffle in the press lately because some people who do feel that there is nothing good about Amazon, and other people I think are critical of organizations that accept the money. Our feeling is that Amazon is enabling us to publish this work. They are covering our author and translator fees, and I cannot criticize that. Mm-hmm. We are very grateful, mm-hmm. and we welcome Amazon's support.
And I imagine you would welcome individual support.
Absolutely. Again, wordswithoutborders.org. There is a donation section on the site. We're entirely grant funded by Amazon, by the NEA, by private foundations, and we depend very much on private donors. In fact, our Afghanistan issue was funded through a Kickstarter campaign, and we welcome donations of any size.
I've been talking with Susan Harris. We've reached the end of our time here. She's editor of the online magazine Words Without Borders. They provide translation of current international fiction, poetry, and essays in English translation. Words Without Borders is the .org is the site. And Susan Harris will be giving a talk at 12:30 this afternoon at the Alumni House on the Utah State University campus. That is part of the English Department Speaker Series, and it's co-sponsored by the Departments of History, Languages, Philosophy, and Speech Communication and the Utah Humanities Council. Recent books and issues of Words Without Borders have featured the writings from the Arab Spring, from Afghanistan, international graphic novels, a Mexican drug war. Very interesting, Words Without Borders. Susan Harris, thanks so much.
Thanks. Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Coming up, my conversation from yesterday with Craig Jessup, Dean of the Kane College of the Arts, talking about Beethoven. Beethoven's Eroica Symphony will be featured Thursday evening on the USU campus. Utah Symphony will be performing with their music director, Terry Fisher. We also talk about Terry Fisher. Craig Jessup was on the search committee. We'll talk about what a music director does and how he is selected, he or she. That conversation is coming up. By the way, we gave away a pair of tickets, but you still can get $2 off your tickets to the Utah Symphony Concert Thursday evening. When you call the box office there, mention you heard this broadcast, they'll give you $2 off. Here's my conversation with Craig Jessup. On this part of the program, we're previewing a concert that'll be happening with the Kane College of the Arts and the Utah Symphony, understand. We have with us the dean of the Kane College of the Arts, Craig Jessup. And Dean, thanks
for
coming.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
So this is Utah Symphony.
Yes.
Be involved, and the headliner is the Eroica Symphony.
That's correct. Let me just say, to bring the Utah Symphony here annually, I think, is one of the top priorities of the Kane College of the Arts. This is one of Utah's greatest musical organizations, one of the crown jewels of the state and of the Western United States. It's one of the great orchestras in the United States, and I've had a long personal affection for this orchestra going back to when I was a boy and heard them very first at South Cache High School with Maurice Bravenel conducting the orchestra. And over the years, I've had many opportunities of performing and being with them, and actually sat on the search committee that hired Terry Fisher, the current director. And I think that in the history of the symphony, Terry is one of the most extraordinary musicians that have ever been on the podium of the Utah Symphony. The musicians are ecstatic. The reviews of his performances are fantastic. He came last spring, as you might remember. It was his debut season with the symphony, and was blown away by the beauty of Cache Valley and the enthusiasm of the patrons. So it's really significant to me to bring the Utah Symphony to Cache Valley, and to have the maestro here with us says a great deal about the emphasis he places on coming here. And the repertoire he's selected is going to open with two works of Mozart. First of all, the overture to La Clemenza di Tito, of Mozart, which was one of the last works that he wrote. He sandwiches it in between the composition of Die Zauberflöte, his last opera, in a very intense time of his life where he was very ill. He fires this little opera off at the same time. And then Piano Concerto No. 26 in D major, The Coronation. And the Utah Symphony has brought with them Ronald Brodegam, who is a Dutch pianist internationally renowned for his interpretation of Mozart. Ronald is also performing in a Bravenel Hall with the symphony, so we're very fortunate. So the two Mozart works are the first half, then the intermission, and then Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, the Eroica Symphony, which is of heroic proportions. Originally dedicated to Napoleon, that Beethoven was quite enthralled with, until after his military conquests, he proclaimed himself as the emperor as well. And it so angered Beethoven that he scratched the dedication out with such ferocity that it left a hole in the manuscript. Nevertheless, he said, "This symphony is to the memory of a great man." Who the great man is now, we don't know, but it was inspired originally by Napoleon. So Mozart and Beethoven, you can't get much better than that.
Talk a little bit about Beethoven for us. We don't have the scope nowadays of how revolutionary he was.
No, he took the sonata allegro form of music, which was brought to its apex by the symphonies of Haydn and Mozart, these two Austrians. And Beethoven took that, and the best way to explain in layman's terms is just expanded the form to unheard of proportions like never before. So perhaps a single movement of a Mozart symphony might last at most 10 minutes, with a single movement of the Beethoven would last perhaps 20 minutes. So when I say expanded the form, it's not only the duration of length, but it's the complexity, still staying within the boundaries of sonata allegro form. But the complexities are something that had never been seen before. He definitely has one foot in the classical period, the classical tradition of Mozart and Haydn. In fact, Symphony No. 1 of Beethoven is very much within that style. You might think if you played Drop the Needle and just said, who wrote that, your first guess might be, oh, that could be Mozart or Haydn. But by the time we get to Symphony No. 9, where he feels like he said everything that he can, and so what does he do? He adds a choir and soloists. First three movements are instrumental, but the fourth is orchestral. And it's like now he sets the stage for what follows after are the great symphonies of Mahler, which in many of the Mahler symphonies, a choir is incorporated into the texture of the composition. Beethoven is without question one of the great, great pillars of the music of Western European civilization.
He set such a standard, I think, that Brahms was stuck. He didn't feel like he could compete or add anything.
Of course, everyone who follows Beethoven lives in the shadow of Beethoven. Although I have to say, Brahms' four symphonies stand up very well on their own. But Brahms was always self-conscious. Beethoven kept every sketchbook he ever wrote. We can see the evolution of his thought. He didn't care what people thought. He sees how he works a theme. Brahms went back and destroyed everything. You cannot see the evolution of the Brahms symphony because he didn't want you to see it. I think Brahms stands well on its own, but there's no question the shadow of Beethoven was always looming there.
Just one more thing. I wanted to follow up with, I hadn't known you were on the search committee for that. That must have been a very interesting experience. What do you look for? And it sounds like you think you've got it with Terry Fisher.
Well, first of all, the committee was 10 people, 5 members of the Utah Symphony from various sections, and 5 members of the committee, of the community. And I was very honored to have been chosen as a member of the community to sit on that. And then you compose an exhaustive list. We were all asked to bring recommendations. I think there were over 150 names. And then you just go through and start culling that list down, inviting people to submit resumes. And then we got our short list, and then we send out a smaller committee to attend the performances of these conductors. Thierry is also the conductor of the BBC Wales Symphony Orchestra, and he's Swiss by birth. He's a flautist by birth. And he has such a great reputation for being, first and foremost, a consummate musician, both as conductor and performer, and then a very wonderful, charismatic personality and style, not only with the musicians, but with the community. Because this is not only a musical position, it's a civic position as well. He has a beautiful wife and two sons. They adore skiing. And as the process unfolded, this was just a perfect match for him personally and his family and for the Utah Symphony. We were very fortunate to attract a man of his stature here, and he also felt very fortunate to land this position with this very distinguished American orchestra.
So what, over time, a music director will mold an orchestra. What are your hopes?
Well, already new blood is coming into the orchestra itself. He came at a time when there were very many senior members of the orchestra that were retiring. So he's had a chance to recruit and bring in wonderful new players. And his name alone has attracted many new players. And I think within about 3 years, you'll see a very new face on the Utah Symphony roster. I know their upcoming 75th anniversary of the Utah Symphony, with great plans for recordings and for touring as well. And it's been many years since they've been able to do that because of the economy. So it's an exciting, really exciting time. I can tell by the expression on the faces of the musicians that it is a new era. They're sitting a little taller. They come out of their rehearsals exhausted but exhilarated by what he's giving them on the podium. It's an exciting era. And to have him come to Cache Valley, he could have sent as an assistant to come, but he personally wanted to come to Cache Valley because he had such a great time when he was here last spring. So don't miss this this opportunity.
Very good. I've been talking with Craig Jessup, Dean of the Kane College of the Arts. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And again, that's the Utah Symphony in Concert. The headline piece is Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, and that's Thursday evening on the Utah State University campus. When you call the box office, mention you heard this broadcast, they'll give you $2 off your tickets. More information at arts.usu.edu. Thanks for listening to Access Utah Today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.